Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:55 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is October 5th. Let's talk about oil for the to begin with. So Brent crude continues to rebound, but it hasn't been especially dynamic. When we look at the size of the upper dynamics we saw, for example, in March, they're much more convincing than we've seen recently. Even the big move that we had in the middle of July was something that you could hang your hat on and say, well, golly, this looks like a bounce. But for the moment, at least, it's not even breaking the sequence of lower rally highs. And moreover, it's still below the psychological $100 level and the region of the 200-day moving average. And that is despite the fact that OPEC Plus announced today that they're going to shave 2 million barrels of supply from the global market. And the US government is due to stop selling oil from the strategic reserve at the end of this month. So that implies an additional loss of 1 million barrels. And oil prices have not rebounded in an emphatic fashion based upon that news. So what that really suggests is that investors are a lot more worried about security of demand than security of supply. There's a temptation to think that demand is a constant, but that's very far from the truth. It's simply that demand doesn't change very often, but when it does change, it generally coincides with significant issues for the oil sector. So OPEC's determination to reduce supply is very much a response to the visceral experience of 2020 when prices collapsed. And we don't see it on Brent crude, but on the WTI chart, well, prices went negative and they got down to $20 on Brent. And if you're an oil producer, that's simply existential risk. Having been through that kind of experience, they're determined to try and ensure that prices stay at levels that they can balance their budgets at. Now, the rest of the world isn't particularly happy with paying $90 for oil. They'd much prefer to be paying 40, 20, 30. But we're in a finely balanced market, and we are looking down the barrel of a global recession. But there's an additional point that I think is worth highlighting, and it is that Saudi Arabia isn't buying bonds any longer. They're relying instead upon direct deposits and their portfolio to support the growth of their foreign assets. So it's their investments that are padding out that rather than the purchases of securities. And in fact, since 2015, they've been net sellers. So I think this is especially important. The petrodollar system has been 100% based, or the foundation of the petrodollar system was based upon the understanding that the USA would provide Saudi Arabia with security guarantees and would buy Saudi Arabia's oil. And in return, Saudi Arabia would reinvest the proceeds from its oil sales into US treasuries. So it was basically a vendor financing agreement, and everyone was happy. But the USA is now an import, is no longer an importer, but a big exporter, and most particularly of natural gas. What's been very clear over the last decade has been the reluctance of the US government to get involved in Yemen, where Saudi Arabia is fighting a proxy war versus Iran. And that hasn't gone unnoticed in Riyadh. So then we think about, well, so the USA is not providing security guarantees or isn't as committed to supplying security guarantees as it was in the past. And they're not buying Saudi Arabian oil either. So why on earth would Saudi Arabia fill the other side of its bargain and be buying their treasuries? So This also removes one of the biggest and most reliable partnership agreements within the geopolitical sphere. It's absolutely inevitable that Saudi Arabia is going to grow closer to China because China is their biggest customer. And then, of course, the question is, in what currency will oil ultimately be priced in, at least for Saudi exports, or will they be willing to accept other currencies? We know, for example, that Russia was willing to accept euro. Now, of course, that was because they were already wondering about the security of having dollar deposits, but they were willing to accept euro deposits and euro payments for their oil and gas. Will Saudi Arabia do something similar? And what would that mean for the dollar and the reserve currency? And is that also part of the Federal Reserve's determination to continue raising rates? It's, I think, an important aspect to the entire tightening cycle that most people, I think, aren't willing to countenance. But one thing we know for certain is that the dollar index rebounded in here today from the 110 area. And this was a key area of potential support if the trend is going to be consistent. So it needed to bounce, and it has bounced. Now, it didn't hold all of the move through the end of the day, but certainly this was a bounce in here today. And 10-year Treasury yields have not collapsed through 3.5% and are rebounding in here as well today. I think a clear or growing conclusion is that the Federal Reserve is not going to err from its determination to raise rates, and unemployment remains at very low levels. Now, job openings have declined, so that's certainly a factor. Is pointing towards some tightening and less enthusiasm on behalf of CEOs. But unemployment is still exceptionally low. The Federal Reserve really has no reason to curtail their interest rate hiking policy. And inflation hasn't yet peaked. And the fact that oil prices are still high, well, all of that contributes to the increasing likelihood that the Federal Reserve will continue to tighten. Now, it's also, I think, particularly relevant here that high yield spreads are north of 500 basis points. Now, we can look at this over plenty of back history. We can see quite clearly that it's a very spiky chart, but that the ultimate peaks have generally coincided with major lows in the market. So in November of 2008, the high yield spread peaked. And that same thing with the correction in 2011, the correction in 2016, the correction in 2020. But we have not yet seen evidence, first of the acceleration higher, although the trend is certainly in place, or a peak. And it isn't until high yield spreads peak that we can really have some faith that the stock market has bottomed. And then I saw this chart earlier on today, which I thought was particularly interesting. It's what you might term the junkiest of junk high yield spread. So it's the CCC rated bonds versus the B rated bonds. And it's also trending higher, and there's no evidence that it has stopped. So we don't have quite the same spikes here. So back in 2011, we didn't have the same pressure on the junk market. We had a big spike in junky bonds in 2016 and in 2020, and it got up to 800 basis points. And that's for bonds that already have high yields on both sides of the spread. So there's no evidence yet of a low being found in the stock market, as long as these are moving higher, this continues to point towards significant tightening. And then, of course, there is the additional aspect to all of this, in that over the course of the last decade, covenant light lending or covenant light bond terms and conditions have predominated. And what we're seeing increasing evidence of is original lenders to companies being denuded of collateral. So a company gets into trouble, and one of the conditions that they're going to be provided with new money is that the collateral that was attached to previous loans will be stripped off it and then attached to new loans. So that basically inconveniences the original lender at the expense, or and then obviously gives a preferential position to the new lender. That helps to avoid a formal default, but the original lenders are then in no position to a recovery, and they're completely dependent on the company being able to continue to make coupon and principal payments. And in the event then that the company gets into further difficulties, well, then it will default on both loans, but the second loan is the one that will have the collateral attached to it, and the original lender will get nothing back, and their recovery rates will be exceptionally low. And this is the format that lots of new funding is taking. That is a recipe for a really significant problem in a recessionary environment, and there is no question that we are heading towards a recession. The quantity of monetary tightening that has already occurred is enough to kick off a recession. And if the Federal Reserve keeps going, then the likelihood of a recession is only going to increase. So then let's just think about the stock market, because it is rebounding. There was a big options trade hit the market in here today. So the Nasdaq is closing out the day just down a tad. But we can clearly see here that around the middle of the afternoon, or well, really shortly after the open, the Nasdaq bottomed and then rallied for most of the day. So we have the dollar rebounding. We have high yield spreads that are rising. We have oil prices that are still steady. And we have the 10-year yield that is bouncing from support. And the stock market is rebounding. Those are mutually incompatible trends. And if August is any guide, the relative strength in the stock market is not going to last indefinitely. So there has to be a rationale for why prices are rebounding. And I think it's simple enough. We're right at the beginning of the quarter. And investors are scrambling for ideas about how to rescue or salvage 2022, and they're coming up short on ideas. So, gold prices had rebounded really quite emphatically, but we're down about $8 in here today, and we're well off the low. If gold is going to persist higher, then we will need to see the dollar breaking the 110 level. And if interest rates continue to march higher, it's going to be a headwind for gold. But the size of the rebound suggests that gold was at the top of the list for people who were looking for a hedge. So that at least is lending some credence to the view that this is just a consolidation within an ongoing secular bull market. Because ultimately, the dollar's relative strength isn't going to persist indefinitely. The size of the debts, the size of the deficit, is eventually going to become a significant headwind. And the only way that the dollar's ultimate demise would be avoided is with significant fiscal consolidation. And we're just not there. or at least there isn't an administration in power at present that's willing to take that kind of hit to its popularity. Then we can think about the energy sector. Well, oil prices being quite steady, they're helping to support speculative sectors. These industrial batteries type of companies were up over the last few days, down in here today, so not quite ready to break out of the base formation just yet. When we think about the big oil companies, well, they obviously should be doing better, and Exxon was in positive territory in here today. Then let's think about some of the more consumer type companies. Nike was up about 3% today, but it's from an exceptionally oversold condition, and it looks increasingly likely that the 200-day moving average is going to fall down through the 1,000-day moving average. And we've had a very meaningful pullback. So the big question then is, should we even be looking at Nike and perhaps instead pay attention to Lululemon, since it is the go-to brand right now and also bouncing from the region of the 1,000-day moving average? So it's not like we don't have at least some evidence here of support building, and value has begun to return. And some brands, some companies will continue to do well even in a recession. But I think it's especially important to make the point that a lot of the factors that supported the semiconductor sector, for example, have eroded. And one of the most important is that supply of semiconductors is going to explode over the next 2 or 3 years. Hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, are being devoted to building out new fabs. Micron Technology is going to build a $100 billion fabrication plant in Syracuse, New York, and employ upwards of 50,000 people. Now, where they're going to find 50,000 people in upstate New York is another question entirely. But they are devoting $100 billion to the project. And the share was in positive territory today. And obviously, they anticipate getting a lot of support from government and taking a good chunk of change out of the Inflation Reduction Act. But when those factories open up, and this one would be the biggest in the world, well, then they're going to flood the market with semiconductors. So that would suggest that the inflation issue might begin to moderate, that there'll be lots of supply, and they'll be have to selling them, or they'll have to sell them at a discount because there's going to be supply coming from everywhere. And that's not great for these companies. So this decade-long period where they have outperformed in no uncertain terms is probably over. And we're going to move back into more of a situation like we had after the Nasdaq bubble in after it burst between 2000 and 2003, where we just go through this exceptionally volatile range where you're going to have moves that could be multiple hundreds of percent from trough to peak, but that we don't get the big trends occurring over the same period. I suspect that that's going to be the most likely scenario. There's people falling over themselves trying to promote the artificial intelligence theme, and the 5G theme has been promoted to ad nauseum over the last 5 or 6 years. The reality is that a lot of the technology that we have today prospered with 4G, and the companies that benefited most were those that could capture the value from the 4G networks. So now we're looking at big data. I think that would probably be the catch-all term for deploying massive computing power to large data sets to come up with new conclusions. That's going to be particularly relevant for materials science, for fertilizers, for crops, for the energy sector, for drug discovery. Those are the kinds of companies that would benefit most from big data. But big data is not the same as autonomous driving. Autonomy and getting a computer to a point where it's capable of making real-time decisions and with sufficient flexibility to cater to events that happen less than 1 in 10,000ths of a percent on occasion, but still be able to have the flexibility to change their mind with that kind of human characteristic. That's not something that's easily fixed with brute force computing. It's going to require a new way of programming. And this promise that's been proposed by Tesla in particular, that they basically are making the pitch today that they're not really a battery company and they're not really a car company, but that they're an artificial intelligence or autonomy company with the release of their robot. And I do think that there is some validity to the argument that Tesla would do better by creating the brain for the for their robot rather than spending their time building the mechanics of the robot, which is what Boston Dynamics have done. But the share is back around 240 and it is trending lower. We have a clear succession of lower rally highs. And this is suggesting that there's not nearly as much enthusiasm around these big promises when interest rates are rising. Now, we've had some phenomenal gains from these big companies, but I just do not believe that there's going to be the same value generated from these eight large companies like we had over the last decade. There will be new themes. And the energy theme is certainly something that has legs because it's a geopolitical imperative now for most countries to be energy independent. And I don't think that's going to change. But then we also have the debt theme, and the quantity of debt is practically beyond comprehension. And the rise of covenant light is a really significant issue in a recession. So we haven't yet gone through a negative earnings season, but it is coming. And that would suggest that we should be prepared for lower values on stock markets. And until those high yield spreads turn around, then we should also, I think that would be the clear indication of a significant market low. And it's also worth considering that lows, I mean, when I say lows, I mean significant multi-year lows in the stock market, haven't generally coincided with lows in the high yield spread. It's rather the opposite. It's when we get peaks in the high yield spread and in the yield curve that we then get evidence of lows in the stock market because liquidity starts to become more available rather than less available. And the high yields, the excuse me, the yield curve spread is still negative by 39 basis points. And this is almost identical to where it was in early 2000. So we have to be prepared for the potential that stock prices could come significantly lower from where they are before real value opportunities become incontrovertible, whereas today they're just beginning to appear. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.